Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio.
This is AppSats Radio, help for partners after sexual betrayal. We talk about it here.
Betrayal trauma.
We are AppSats certified clinical partner specialists and coaches who have been trained to help navigate you through this crisis. There is nothing we won't talk about.
So I've got Amy on the line. Amy, welcome to the show. What's your question?
Well, I have a question about what healthy sexuality looks like when a sex addict is in recovery.
One of the things we know about research and sex addicts is that they don't necessarily want sex with their own wife. And so to me, that says he's in really good recovery because he does want that with you. He has been 2 years sober. He has been in three facilities. And I suspect that's how he's wanting closeness with you.
And I would absolutely agree with that. You know, intimacy is something that takes a long time to develop after partner betrayal. And for so many men, they struggle with sexuality. They've trained their brain to want certain things, and now that they want to invest in the relationship, it can be very difficult to know, you know, how to really make this work. And so today we're going to have an expert on. She is an amazing clinician who has written many books on intimacy. Her name is Dr. Alex Katahakis, and she has written a workbook called Self-Designing and Celebrating Your Sexual Health Plan. And this workbook is for sex addicts. And you may go, well, what's she doing on the partner show? Well, we all know that partners want to find out what resources are available for their spouses. And how do they go about attaining that, right? And so I am just very happy that we are able to get her on the show to talk about sexuality in general. And when someone with compulsive sexual problematic behavior, when they come into the office, how can they work with their therapist towards healthy sexual reintegration? And that's what we're going to be talking about today here in just a few minutes. Now, I want to check in with everybody. You know, it is the beginning of March, and as we all know, COVID last year. And so many people ask me, being a sex addictions specialist, they say, oh, did that make that worse for the sex addict? Did he have more time on his hands? Was he faced with more screen time? Or did it make it better because he was faced perhaps with more family time and more partner time? And what I absolutely believe is that most of my addicts have done remarkably better being home with the family and not having as many temptations per se out there in the real world. If you've got a spouse who's a porn addict, of course that may mean he is confined screen time. But the truth of the matter is, so many times porn addicts turn into sex addicts that actually act out outside of the home too. So it's really been a much better year for the majority of them. I would love to say for everybody, but we know there is no way that's true. And I've actually talked to some colleagues that thought it was worse. So maybe the Midwest has something different than other parts of the world. You know, I really believe if you're listening to the show, you're wanting information. You're wanting information on what works. There is no doubt you've been devastated. You have been devastated by partner betrayal. And now you want to know how to get back on course and back into your own life. And so, if you're a partner and you've just experienced discovery, you got to work at being safe and stable. And if you've been dealing with this for a few years, 10 years, 20, 30, I'm going to ask you, have you grieved and mourned the loss of what you thought you had, what you didn't have, what you wanted to have, and what you do have? And there's a lot of anger that's involved in that. And so get with a partner-sensitive therapist that will help you work through the anger, the grief, and the mourning. And if they're worth their weight, and of course they are because they're partner-sensitive, if they have graduated, if you will, from AFSAT, they've got the proper training to know how to work with you. But if they're worth their weight in gold, they probably are going to refer you to a coach too. Because AFSAT trains coaches to develop specialties that can help you through your crisis. You know, we've got coaches that are divorce coaches. We've got coaches that are gaslighting coaches. We have coaches that specialize in group work for women. We have coaches that specialize in couples work and teaching relational skills. They don't do couples therapy, but they do couples work. And so I would encourage you to go to apsats.org. Apsats.org is partner sensitive. It was the premier organization that was created. You know, we realized that your brain was offline. We knew that the trauma had caused some brain dysfunction, only temporary, but still, when you need your brain the most and you can't function, that doesn't help you much. And so we trained clinicians and coaches to know how to treat you, know how to get you back into safety and stabilization, teach you skills that help you to ground and resource, because that is what you need most. And I think you would agree, would you not? I mean, truth of the matter is, more than anything, you want to feel like yourself again. And to do that requires that you go through the stages of loss, right? That's exactly right. And then when you get to the other side, you know, you can feel what post-traumatic growth is like. And you can know that you have really done a good job of learning the skills it took to make you feel better. And that's why we at AFSAPS believe that you have to go through those phases and stages so that you will know what does make you feel better. What can you actually learn? Who can you learn from? That's AFSATS.org, APSATS.org. And this show is sponsored by AFSATS because we want specialists on that can teach you new information. You know, returning to a healthy sexual relationship is complex, and oftentimes partners want to know that their spouse will not be triggered by sexuality, right? And so resuming a sexual relationship may be difficult because you don't feel safe, or you wonder if it's safe for him. Of course, after working with partners like I have, and like we have at AFSATS, we know that oftentimes you're afraid of being compared to unhealthy sexual images that he has put in his brain for years and years and years. And you want to know that your husband is thinking about you while you are working on your intimacy. And so, do you get close to your husband and wonder if he's thinking of someone else? Wonder if he's thinking about pornography. Wonder if he's thinking about that old affair partner. Well, that's work that you can actually do. Well, we're going to be talking today about what sex addicts can do to retrain their brain to know what's healthy in the terms of their own sexuality and their own sexual reintegration. So I want to welcome a good friend, Dr. Alex Katahakis, who wrote this workbook, and, you know, she made it her own. I think she's kind of a sexuality specialist anyway. She does a lot of work around sexual integration and healthy sex and what is emotional intimacy. And that's what we love to know, because that's what you want back in your life. So, Dr. Katahakis, how are you today?
I'm well, Carol. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, I was so excited when I saw that you had written this book, Sexual Reflections. It's actually a workbook for sex addicts for designing and celebrating their sexual health plan. And tell us a little bit about what made you write the book.
Well, the model actually came out of my dissertation, which was creating a sexual health model for sex addicts. And for years, really since the inception of the model in 1983, when Patrick Carnes wrote Out of the Shadows, was never really considered, quote, sex-positive model, because Carnes' original model was just about stopping the problematic behavior, and there was nothing in his model, as you know, that had to do with partners, families, healthy sexuality. He was just one man trying to figure out this one problem. And so he really was attacked quite a bit by the sex therapy community as being sex negative, because there was no healthy sex involved in the recovery of sex addiction. And this has gone on for a very, very long time. So with the advent of my dissertation and creating this workbook, the sex addiction model is now a sex positive model, because this is a model for being sexual again. So it was unexpected to me. I didn't expect this workbook to happen, but it was the part of my dissertation that I wrote the fastest and the most creative part of it.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. And I know that your book is in part developed from that psychobiological approach to sex addiction treatment. And so will you talk a little bit about PSAT? What is that, and how does that apply to the men that we work with, and maybe even the women?
Yeah, all human beings, actually. Well,
yeah.
I just took Alan Shore's regulation theory, which really looks at the human being not just as a psychological creature, but a creature that's a neurobiological creature, an organism. And that means that it's not just our psychology. It is our nervous system, our neurochemicals, everything that's going on in our individual systems that impacts who we are and what we do and why we do what we do. And so in that book, in the Sex Addiction as Affect Dysregulation book, I looked very closely at why somebody would become a sex addict. And I looked at developmental neuroscience going way back to infancy to see what happens when a child is not properly attuned to by its primary caregiver, which is typically the mother. And so it's not regulated. Its nervous system isn't regulated. If you have an anxious mother or depressed mother or a neglectful mother, then that child's nervous system is not going to come to fruition in an appropriate way. It won't be what we call securely attached, which is the same as regulated, essentially. And so a child that is insecure, cannot regulate itself, didn't have a mother or family system doing that, is typically going to seek something outside themselves to make themselves feel better. And whether that's drugs, alcohol, sex, shopping, you name it, we live in an addicted nation, and so it's very easy to find a substitute community and a substitute attachment figure, you know, which can even be a laptop with pornography on it, to make oneself feel better. So the way I work, and this is also a continuation of the Carnes model, which is strictly a cognitive behavioral model, I've added an affective piece to how we work, So that we're working these traumatic structures simultaneously with the task work, so that people are not just stopping their behaviors, but changing literally the structure and function of their brains and nervous systems over time.
Well, that makes so much sense. And, you know, obviously, as you were putting this model together, you actually write this workbook for clinicians to work with sex addicts. Do you find that sex addicts buy this workbook and bring it into clinicians to learn how to retrain their brain as well as to experience life from a different viewpoint, you know, kinesthetically through sight, touch, sound, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, some people have told me that they bought the book and took it to therapy. The reason it's meant to be used with the therapist is because I tried to do something somewhat oxymoronic, and that was make a workbook that was affectively informed, meaning emotionally informed, instead of just cognitively informed. So if you ask anybody, sex addict or not, what they think a good idea might be about their sex life, they might just throw a dart at the wall. And a sex addict might just say, oh, the things I was doing, you know, in my addiction. But the question I'm posing in the workbook is that really true? And can you track down into your body? And what is the feeling that you're feeling? And the therapist is meant to assist the client in noticing what their experience is physically when they write about something or they think there's something, a particular sex act that they like, to find out if they are feeling you know, shame, and if it's shame, is it toxic shame? Is it shame related to their childhood abuse? Or is it appropriate shame? Or is it shame because they got some sort of message that sex was just bad, dirty, and wrong? So what kind of shame is it, and how can we tease that out, and how can the person write about it to get clear about what is really true for me, what really does turn me on? And can I be unvarnished and honest with myself about that so that I am deconstructing shame enough to eventually be able to own it for myself and then eventually communicate it to a partner?
Well, and you know, the interesting thing is that most men and women have not really had good education around sexuality to begin with.
Right.
And so, as I was looking at your workbook, I was thinking, this is really something that could apply to anybody because
right,
of
yeah.
the inherent shame of what so many people feel and think about sex in general. So I was really impressed with the fact that it could convert over, even though it is not written specifically for that. It's written for, you know, a specific arousal template, if you will, that brings about lots of shame because of all the pain that's occurred as a result of the addiction. Would you kind of break down the workbook into the different sections, how you approach helping someone sexually reintegrate?
Yeah, I want to say that I've had couples work with this workbook, and in fact, we have a 12-week coaching class here at Center for Healthy Sex. It's virtual, of course, and you know, couples will sign up for that 12 weeks with a sex expert here, and we go through the workbook with them. And obviously, there's one section on the sex addiction cycle that's not relevant to the partners at all, but the rest of it is, and it allows the couples to go through these different dimensions with each other and start to talk about these things. And just to my slight defense, the reason I had to narrow this to sex addicts was because, you know, when you write a dissertation, it's got to be a very narrow topic. So I had to just look at the addict. Someone else could just, you know, do a similar study and just look at partners of people that have been betrayed. So that's why it's narrowly focused on the sex addict. But the model does have five dimensions. The first one is the physical dimension. So we're asking people to make the distinction between sexual behaviors that were hurtful or exploitive or shameful from sexual behaviors that bring us dignity and a sense of well-being. And then also looking at sexual response cycle for both females and males, because again, as you stated, we get so little sex education in our culture that to really know first of all, that you have a sexual response cycle and what it is that brings you pleasure and, you know, what's optimal functioning for you. And then understanding sexual anatomy, which, you know, many of us kind of got in ninth grade biology, but to really understand the way your physiology works and also to be able to communicate it to a partner, you know, especially as we age. And we have so much shame about our bodies and that they're aging or they don't work the same way they did or, you know, your back won't let you have the kind of athletic sex you once had maybe. These are parts of grief and loss as we age and go forward, but they shouldn't hamper our sex lives if we can be vulnerable and talk about them. So that's where the workbook starts, and then it moves into the affective dimension. So we're really looking at whether people feel guilty or shameful about sex and sexual behaviors. We want to make sure they're not reenacting previous traumas or dissociative feelings where they're sort of leaving their body during sex or having sex because, you know, for women, maybe they have pelvic pain disorders and they don't want to talk about it. And then getting people to track and name impulses in their body so that they can use these impulses and emotions as a guide to what's really true for them, as opposed to trying to think it through and figure it out, to say, huh, what does this feel like in my body? Does it make me feel open-hearted? Do I notice a stirring in my genitals? Or do I feel sick to my stomach or tightness in my chest or like I'm shutting down? So we want,
and
you know, in this,
May I ask you something? Because you and I both know, especially with people that have experienced trauma, that their body keeps score. So as you have done this work with sex addicts, have their bodies told you and them something that they didn't know about themselves?
Yes, on occasion, but typically by the time people are working with this workbook, they've done a lot of work on themselves. This is not a workbook someone picks up in the first year of sobriety. Typically, they've gone through a lot of, you know, treatment and the disclosure process and looking at their own issues, et cetera. So that is, you know, it's not like somebody comes up against a major a sexual issue in that case. So, but
okay.
They will start to notice that, oh, that sexual thing that I was doing in my addiction, you know, that I thought I enjoyed so much was really making me feel kind of humiliated or shameful. And yet I keep going back to it, and somebody will keep going back to it because these are adaptive strategies from way back. And, you know, the brain and the body just keep replicating this thing over and over again. So the workbook has a place for those kind of behaviors where we put them on what I call a watch and wait list. So we keep digging and excavating and looking at what's really okay and what isn't okay.
And so I clearly hear you say that obviously people have done a lot of hard work, but whenever I think about the clients that I've had in EMDR that have done a real body scan, sometimes it opens up some thoughts that they were unaware of in regards to what their body is telling them. So I was just checking that out because, you know, we don't get enough time to really pay attention to what our bodily experiences are. And like you said, sometimes it brings insight as to something they thought they liked to do that was really a trauma reenactment from something in their childhood or a way to express more guilt and shame because they did feel those things growing up as a child. So continue with the five areas.
So I think just, you know, kind of wrapping up, the affective one is about being able to communicate thoughts and feelings, being vulnerable, all the things that are required for long-term, you know, intimacy and sexuality, so that sex starts to feel pleasurable. And that doesn't mean it's not erotic and it's not fun or experimental, but it adds to the person's dignity and self-worth. It's not robbing them of it. And then the cognitive dimension is the third dimension, where we, you know, are helping people set appropriate boundaries so that they know when they can say no, they can hear no from another, they're not violating their dignity or their body by engaging in unwanted sexual experiences or taking advantage of the other person through physical or psychological manipulation. And if someone's single, there's an updated dating plan with the sexual health plan in this workbook. So I'm asking people to be very intentional, to turn everything over with a fine-tooth comb, which most people don't do. You know, people in recovery have to look at their sexuality, and most people just don't. They kind of go through the motions. They're not really intentional, and they're not really present in the process, because shame is such a huge part of the way we've constructed sex and sexuality in our country. The next dimension is about connecting, you know, with the other person and with yourself. So I call it the interpersonal and interpsychic. So that means you can talk with a partner about everything, your sexual experiences, your STIs, your sexual health, your addictions. The person can be comfortable with a wide range of sexual experiences, including masturbation and how to discuss that with a partner, a friend or therapist or a love interest, because if you can't talk about sex without giggling and being uncomfortable, you can't have sex. You're not going to be able to have what Peggy Kleinplatz, who's a major sex researcher, calls optimal sexual experiences. You're going to be really sort of stuck in a more immature sexual pattern. And I'm interested in people creating and having what I call an adult sexuality. So that means they can talk about the lubrication they need, the positions they need, what they like, what they don't like. And we can start by doing this, you know, with a therapist, for starters, that doesn't have their own hang-ups about sex either. And then really just choosing sexual preferences that are congruent for the person's body, mind, soul, you know, gender identity, et cetera. And then the last dimension is the spiritual dimension, where people have made a conscious choice about their spiritual or religious preferences through whatever avenue they've chosen, whether it's 12-step mentoring, clergy, and that they can discuss those choices with their therapist and with their partner and how that aligns with their sexuality. And I'm hoping for people that their spiritual and religious beliefs enrich their sexual experiences instead of providing shame and guilt, because you really can't have optimal sex when there's shame and guilt running around in your head. And, you know, hopefully as people mature into their sexuality, they can become fluid during sex, they can make meaningful connections, they can really use sex as a way to connect deeply with their partner for purposes of regulation and nonverbal communication and creating, you know, a third energy, if you will, that connects them to the divine. And so that is the aspiration of the workbook, and it's really done through their exercises at the end of every chapter. There are pictures to be colored, and those pictures are quite they're projective pictures by design, so you can project all sorts of things onto them. And then I ask people to write a memory story or a poem that the picture evokes at the end of every chapter, and those are really fun to hear from people. And a lot of material comes up from the art and from the writing at the end of every chapter.
Well, you know, what you are sharing with us is obviously a healthy sexual plan, and that is what this workbook is to create for each person who is looking at understanding their sexuality and having healthy sexuality. Now, obviously, you mentioned things that bring about shame. And what I'm hearing you to say is that masturbation, for instance, is often not allowed in certain 12-step groups. And if that's the case, the therapist would honor that. But for other people, they don't believe that masturbation is necessarily a gateway to acting out. And so for that person, the sexual plan would look different. Is that correct?
Yes. I mean, this is a really hot topic in recovery circles. You know, I'm in Los Angeles, so our primary fellowship is SAA, and it's huge. There are so many people in this fellowship, and I love the fellowship because it's very broad-based. It's open to anyone. It's not restrictive. It's not judgmental in any way, shape, or form. And I believe that people should have a personal sexuality. So if they are not having sex with their partner for 6 months or a year, masturbation should be an outer circle behavior. Now, there are some people, you know, and over the years I've had clients say to me, Alex, I can never masturbate again. That was my primary addiction. All I did was masturbate to porn for hours, and I'm not doing that ever again. And that's their right. That's their life. Other people will say, masturbation was never my thing. I was only ever acting out with live people. And pornography was not their thing either, so they could kind of take or leave it. So if they do masturbate in a healthy way, which is really about connecting to the sensations of their body, allowing their imagination about their partner or perhaps other scenarios that don't have to do with past sexual experiences, then that's perfectly healthy and fine for them. But this has to be well thought out. It's got to be talked about. It certainly has to be talked about with the person's partner, whether they're male or female, about sort of what the understanding is about that. And, you know, if the partner feels threatened, why they feel threatened. And again, if this was a real problem in the relationship, then it's not something that should be introduced again too sooner or at all. But I really think it's a case-by-case basis. I get very worried about blanket statements about anything in sexual recovery, honestly, because people are so different and sexuality is so, so different.
Well, I absolutely understand that, and I would agree 100%. There is that understanding, and this makes sense, and I'm sure it's going to make sense to you, that when a man masturbates, if he has acted out or if he has looked at years and years and years of pornography, it may toggle to those old images. And so we probably have partners listening that are going, oh, my gosh, this healthy sexuality plan could actually trigger my husband. And so I just wanted you to address that, especially for the partners who, you know, their greatest fear is that they can't live a healthy life again with their addict and have a satisfying sexual relationship.
Well, again, it really depends on the person and how much recovery they have. And when men start to reintroduce masturbation, those that do, they will, you know, have flashes in their head of porn if they've looked at a lot of porn, because these are neuronal networks and patterns that are firing together. And masturbation and porn and imagery are all wired together because they've been firing together so long. So typically the instruction I give people is, if you're going to do this on the honor system and you're really earnest about doing it, then if those images start to pop into your head, you need to stop. That's all. You just stop. Just like if you're having sex with your wife and all of a sudden some image flashes into your head, it's not that person's fault. These are associations that are being made. These are networks that are firing off. They're involuntary. It's like having a sexual dream. You know, we really can't do anything about that. But what the person can do during sex is to stop, get present, make eye contact with their partner, breathe, talk to their partner, you know, smell her hair, feel the texture of her skin, and bring themselves back into the present moment. So slowing down is really essential in sex if you're going to be intentional. And that's sort of the first step in erotic intelligence. You know, the first step is healthy sex, which is about simple, connected, slowing down sexuality so that the body and brain can start to reacclimate to what it feels like to touch and be touched. Someone that you love, that you're close to, but that you've also really harmed deeply. And so the pain is a big part of sex early on, and a lot of people, quite frankly, can't tolerate that. They want it to be back the way it used to be. And so the males are very, you know, much wanting to get to penetrative sex and kind of get on with it. And the women are terrified, and they're tracking their partner's every move, trying to control what they're thinking and whether they're getting triggered or not. And it's a mess. Honestly, but when both people can really slow down and they can agree that they are going to be conscious and intentional about their own bodies and what they're feeling and what they need, and they're going to communicate every step of the way, they may or may not have an orgasm, they may or may not finish, but at least they've had an intimate, close-in experience with each other that's honest. And that doesn't mean they won't ever again get to really hot animalistic sex. They will, but this is like, you know, learning to walk all over again with each other. So it's a slow and deliberate process is, I think, my point.
Yes, absolutely. And I think you made it very, very clear that it's up to every individual and couple to decide what works for them. And that negotiation and compromise between sex addict and partner can be a little tough, but ultimately it's the sex addict who is on the honor system. You know, now I definitely know that there have been partners that have wanted to include, you know, questions on a polygraph, like, are you fantasizing about old pornography stars while you're with me? And and that's a different question than, have you had quick images of, you know, porn stars? Obviously, that has to do with trust, and it has to do with his recovery. How good
right,
his recovery
but again,
is he in? Go ahead.
I think that's a very challenging question, because if somebody's having a fantasy or a thought or, again, a dream, we can't control those things. We can intervene on them. You can't intervene on a dream unless you're a lucid dreamer. But sure, somebody will have those images. But I worry that women collapse under that and they compare themselves to that instead of recognizing that, yeah, his brain is distorted. He's got all these images in his head, and I'm going to hold on to myself, and I'm going to be a secure woman, and I'm going to connect to my sexuality. And this guy is either doing the work he's meant to be doing or he's not. And if he's not, I'm going to know it. And then that tells me something about this person and this marriage. But I worry for women that, you know, their sexuality gets so bludgeoned and collapsed, and then they're still tracking and looking and wondering what he's up to, that her sexual pleasure just, like, goes under the bus and stays under the bus. And I know this is a very delicate balance, what I'm saying, but it's not just that the addict's on the honor system. It's that he's either in recovery or he isn't. That's my feeling about it. And he's either taking responsibility for kind of the garbage that floats through his head on any given day, or he's not. And that's really the harder work, is the vigilance about being activated, triggered. And that's why program is so important, you know, that people go to meetings regularly and get current with people in meetings, with their therapists about, yeah, you know, I had these thoughts today. It's like, so I wouldn't expect you to have any other thoughts today, actually, given what you've put yourself through and your brain through all these years. But over time, images do start to disappear. They do.
Yes, they do. And I love the fact that you brought it back to something I'm always talking to partners about, which is, if you have that kind of insecurity, you need to be talking with a therapist about it. And then, in addition to that, what can you do to get back into your own sense of sexuality, your own sense of confidence, so that you can be your own person regardless? Now, the truth of the matter is, she didn't know what she didn't know, but now that she
right.
does know, she will figure it out. If she, women know their husbands very, very well, and they will figure
right.
it out. If he is back in the fantasy land and it's full-fledged, that means he isn't in good recovery, she'll know. So in the meantime, the number one thing, obviously, a partner worries about is being deceived and duped, and yet to live as if that's happening at every juncture is not living at all.
Well, no, that's hypervigilance, and it's really, you know, a good way for someone to make themselves sick because they're just blasting cortisol through their systems at all time. It's really not healthy at all. So if somebody, for example, is having sex with their partner and their partner looks like they're checked out or elsewhere, you know, for the woman to be able to stop and say, can we just slow down for a minute? It looks like you were fantasizing about someone else or you were gone. And if he can be vulnerable enough to say, you know what, you're right, I'm so sorry. And for her to not take it personally and say, oh, my God, he's doing this to me, as opposed to, oh, he's still not well. And where do we go from here? Can she in that moment say to him, can you look at me? Can you connect with me? Can we just be together right now? And if he can say yes, and there's something really healing in that. If he can't, then you stop. If you're hurt because of it, well, you're hurt because of it. But again, that's why these are such complicated matters, and we cannot control each other. I had a woman once say to me, it was such a sad thing, she said, you know, I don't want to give him my erotic self and my sexuality anymore, because I am a sexual being, and I love sex, and I feel like that's something I want to withhold from him. I don't want to give that to him, and that, you know, I understand that, especially in early discovery and recovery. But over time, that's sort of cutting off your nose to spite your face. Like, I don't know where the win is in that. And that's what happens when people aren't in really explicit, painstaking conversations about their sex life. All these projections fly and hurt feelings and upset and you know, and I think what both people want desperately is to connect with each other, but all too often the traction is the arguing instead of the velocity that comes from sex.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree. And again, you hit the nail on the head when you said that sex is about communication. And we always say that the largest sex organ is your brain. And so
mm-hmm.
couples need to be talking about this, and so many couples didn't talk about it pre-discovery. And
right.
then, of course, at the time of discovery, there's very little talk about it. And as the relationship begins to evolve and recovery kicks in, and he's walking his talk and he's working on his sexuality, she needs to be working on hers, and that means they both need to be talking about sex. So as our partners and some sex addicts are listening to this show, you know, Dr. Alex and I we're just pleading with you to be able to talk about sexuality. And if you don't know how to do that, you can get this workbook, even though it's really meant to be a vehicle for therapy. And or you can get other books. What other books would you recommend, Dr. Alex, for improving sexuality?
Yeah, I mean, Erotic Intelligence is a good first step for people just to start answering questions with each other. And I want to say a good place to start with your partner is to say, this is so awkward and so uncomfortable for me, and I'd rather, you know, stick forks in my eyes than have this conversation. But I'm going to do it because I want to know what my sexuality is about. I want to grow up in my sexuality because our sexuality changes from decade to decade. We are not the same people. And we're certainly not the same people going through discovery. And so to come out the other end and say, okay, our recovery is not finished until we restore our sex lives, because a lot of people stop there. They are, you know, friendly again, they're parenting again, they save their marriage, but they don't go all the way with it. And sex and sexuality is the portal to your spiritual life, to your deep connection with your partner. And so why stop before you hit the finish line? Also, after Erotic Intelligence, the Burkha's book, The Couple's Guide to Intimacy, is a helpful book too. But you know, with many of these books, you really do need a good couples therapist that can help you talk about the discomfort or difficulties you're facing when you get to these sexual acts and dates and things of that matter. So you don't have to do it alone, I guess, is the point.
Well, and you bring up a very good point in terms of finding that therapist. And you know, both Dr. Alex and I are CSATs, which are Certified Sexual Addiction Therapists. You'll want to interview your CSATs to find out how comfortable they are talking about healthy sexuality, because a lot of them actually are trained in how to get somebody into recovery, but not necessarily trained to talk about sexuality, certainly ASEX, and that's the American Association of Sex Educators, Counselors, and Therapists. They have been trained specifically on how to bring back, for the second time, or perhaps for the first time, how to bring you into that sexual reintegration. And so you can go to that website and find out who might be available in your area. I know we're doing virtual right now, but there are therapists that are starting to have face-to-face, at least here in the Midwest. And, you know, I'm a big believer, and when you're talking sex, if you can, face-to-face is always best. I don't know. What do
right,
you think?
Because, well, we're talking about intimacy. So, yes, being in the same room, dealing with your discomfort is really the best. I just want to make a caveat that if somebody does find an ASEC-trained therapist, you want to interview them and make sure they believe in sex addiction, because a lot of them don't. So you don't want someone who is going to undo all the good work you've done or make you feel like you just wasted, you know, a year of your life and tons of money. There are ASEC therapists that are sex addiction friendly, so just be careful about that. And people can always call Center for Healthy Sex. We've got resources all over the country. So if we can't help you, we can refer you to someone we think would be appropriate. And our number is 310-843-9902. And you can find us online at centerforhealthysex.com.
Very good. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Katahakis, for sharing your workbook with us. What a fascinating project it is. You have been a beacon for healthy sexuality for as long as I've been in the field. And again, her workbook is called Sexual Reflections, a workbook for designing and celebrating your sexual health plan. Thanks again, and I look forward to more conversations.
Thank you so much, Carol.
Were you going to say one other thing? I heard a...
I don't think so.
Okay. Yes, well, the center is so amazing, and it's helped so many of my clients. And so would you give them the website one more time?
Sure. It's centerforhealthysex.com.
All right. Okay, thanks again, and look forward to more projects.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Okay, so then again, that was Dr. Alex Katahakis. And she is, I do believe, the director of Center for Healthy Sex. And I know she might have talked about some things that could have been triggering. And that's something to talk about, too, with your therapist, with your coach, in your group. Or you can always send me an email. And as I say at the end of every show, there will only be one of you at all times. I fearlessly want you to have the courage to be yourself and talk about sex. We'll see you next week for more Betrayal Recovery Radio here from appsats.org. Make it a good one.
For more information, go to appsats.org, the Association of Partners of Sex Addicts Trauma Specialists, to find a professional in your area who is trained to help you after sexual betrayal.